Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thank you so much for joining us for another edition of this podcast. And thank you to all of the new followers and listeners who have joined us in the past few days. Appreciate you getting on board. If you're new to the Wax Ecstatic podcast, allow me to explain what we do here as we bring you this podcast every Tuesday and Friday. I, like you, have a bunch of baseball cards from my childhood days just sitting somewhere in a dark closet way in the recesses of our homes. Maybe you have a basement in your house. We don't have too many of those here in Florida, but you've got them stored away somewhere. And even though my childhood card collection is nowhere near as large as it used to be, I still have a few boxes of cards. And not too long ago, I was rummaging through this big monster box of cards, 5,000 cards, all with baseball cards from the 1980s. And I thought it'd be fun to rummage through there, pull a card at random, talk about the card, the player, and anything else that's on my mind. And we've just finished up 1983. Our last podcast was on the 83 top set. We're moving into 1984, which is just a great year for me and my life. Hopefully it was for you as well. It was a great year for baseball fans too. We'll talk about all of that later on in the podcast. And it was also a great year for baseball cards. And today we're taking a look at 1984 Donruss. And what do you know? What are the odds that this is the card that I pull? I've got a couple hundred of 84 Donruss sitting in this box. And the one card that I pull is the one guy we brought up throughout the 1983 discussions. In fact, I had a tweet about it not too long ago. It's Ron Kittle, card number 244. Yes, that's the card we pulled. So we will talk about the rise and stupendous fall of Ron Kittle in Major League Baseball. Still very involved in the Chicago White Sox organization, by the way. But we'll talk about him in the 84 Donruss set, which was, like 83 Fleer, really a benchmark set for Donruss. They finally, after three clunky sets, got the whole thing right. And we'll talk about that in a little bit. First, I want to hear what you have to talk about. So this is the time that we take a look at our questions and comments on our Twitter feed. That's at Wax and Gumstains. Again, at Wax and Gumstains. You are free to comment, throw out questions, thoughts about baseball cards whenever you want. And in response to our 83 Tops podcast, we've got a few questions and comments. First of all, from Cheese Curd. That's why I love communicating through Twitter. You never know what Twitter handles you're going to come across. CheeseCurd76, a little bit of a housekeeping question. Where's episode number one? Now, this is in reference to our move from SoundCloud to Audioboom. I had already removed episode one from the SoundCloud feed, so I just didn't have it handy. I still have it, but it just didn't make its way to the Audioboom page. So CheeseCurd76, don't get upset. Episode 1 will eventually find its way back onto Audioboom. It was really just an introductory piece as to who I am and how I got into collecting baseball cards and how I got back into the hobby, granted at a much lesser level than when I was a kid. But, you know, there's some interesting stories to share there, but really, mostly you want to hear about the cards and not necessarily about me. So it will eventually get back up there, but you're not missing anything. You're not going crazy. It does start with episode number two, which was the 81 Fleer set. John Upshaw chiming in as we were talking about in all three of the 83 sets, there were the three big rookie cards. Of course, Ryan Sandberg, Wade Boggs, and Tony Gwynn. They were in all three of the sets, and we talked extensively about those. And John asked the question, how many of the big three did you hit? I don't have any of them right now. Again, my collection's a lot smaller than it used to be. I'm not as aggressive going out there and buying baseball cards. I mean, after all, I do have a wife and two kids to take care of, so you have to spend wisely. But it's so funny because even though these were the three big rookie cards of 83, and I grew up in the 80s, I never got them. And there's a couple of reasons why. Now, the first reason is that I never went shopping for single cards. My way of collecting back when I was a kid and still nowadays is through packs. I loved buying packs of cards and ripping through them and just the element of surprise on what was inside that pack besides the rock hard bubble gum. if you were buying tops. So I used to love buying packs. And when I got older and started making a little more money doing odd jobs around the house and mowing the neighbor's yard, I would save up my money and then buy boxes. I used to love buying wax boxes and tearing through those and organizing them and trying to build a set. I never really bought single cards. I never, really tried to, you know, even when I went to baseball card shows, I didn't try to pick off the star cards or the big rookie cards that were several years old. I always just bought packs and boxes of packs. I never even bought complete sets. It was just not my way of collecting. So the rare times that I could afford a pack of 1983 cards, be it Topps, Fleer, or Donruss, and that's the key thing, rare times, because again, I didn't have a ton of money. And think about it, even in, you know, 1992, 93, I'm 15, 16 years old. I've got a little more disposable income in my hands. I remember packs of 83 Topps and Fleer and Donruss. I mean, they were selling for like, you know, $15. And, you know, why spend $15 on one pack where I might get that player when for $20 back then, you could still get an entire box of cards. John followed up in our initial conversation with, all three of them are dirt cheap now, and they probably are. And that's why 25 plus years ago, I didn't buy single cards. Not that I could foresee the economical future of baseball cards and the values, you know, plummeting over the years and just kind of settling to where they are now. But you're right, John, you know, now's a good time to buy low. And finally, we have Alex Hyde checking in. Alex actually responding to a tweet that we sent out on Sunday. And the tweet was, did you dump your Boggs, Sandberg, or Gwynn for the Kittle? And of course, we were promoting our 83 Topps discussion. And Alex responded with, not the Kittle, but I did trade the Sandberg for Willie McGee twice. Oh, that's a tough one. All these years later, I bet that still hurts. You traded Sandberg for Willie McGee, not just once, but twice. A little bit of trader's remorse, I suppose. Well, if it makes you feel any better, you're not the only one who's stinging from that. You know, the reason why we ask that question is I've heard numerous horror stories from people, you know, card shop owners and card collectors from back in 1983. They were ripping open those packs looking for Ron Kittle, who was setting the world on fire. Gwynn, Sandberg, and Boggs had good starts to their careers, but of course, in the middle of the 1983 season, you had no idea that you were dealing with three Hall of Fame players right there. You were just going for what was hot back then. And if it makes you feel any better, Alex, you know, the Cubs did acquire Ryan Sandberg for Ivan DeJesus. So at least you weren't in charge of the Phillies giving up Sandberg and Larry Boa, by the way, for Ivan DeJesus, who played, I believe, just three seasons with the Phillies before he was traded again. His career was done, I think, in 88. And, you know, Sandberg's career was just really ascending to the peak by then. So, Alex, I feel your pain. I've had some bad trades before, but not to the extent of Sandberg from Willie McGee twice. All right. Now, the man who was at the heart of that original question, again, our random poll, and this is an honest to God random poll here, Ron Kittle. We're taking a look at the 84 Donruss set. It is card number 244. Now, normally I talk about the card and then about the player. I'm going to reverse that this time around, talk a little bit about the player, because Ron Kittle is one of those fascinating stories, in my opinion. If there was ever a reason to do a 30 for 30 on a guy who had just one really good year and has been pretty much forgotten ever since, it's Ron Kittle. And by all accounts, he's not a bad person, and he certainly wasn't a bad baseball player. He's a guy who had one season just in the spotlight and then mysteriously just fell off the map for the longest of times. So Ron Kittle, or Ronald Dale Kittle, as you'll see on the back of this 84 Donruss card, was actually property of the Dodgers. He was signed as a free agent back in 1977, and he was with the Dodger organization for a year, and they cut him loose. And Here's why, and this is where baseballreference.com is just a beautiful thing. He played for two teams in the Dodger organization, rookie ball and A ball, Lethbridge and Clinton. And you look at his stats from that year, he hit .229, 7 home runs, 24 RBI in 56 games. And then before they cut him loose in 1978, he appeared in just 13 games for Clinton, and this is A ball, by the way, hitting .143, 0 home runs, 4 RBI. So don't yell at the Dodgers organization for cutting him loose in 1978. They gave him a year look-see, and he really didn't produce anything. So this is where the fascinating story of Ron Kittle comes around. Kittle was actually a steel worker at this time. He just couldn't cut it in pro ball. He gets signed by the Chicago White Sox, and by 1982, he makes it to the major leagues, has a pretty, well, average debut. 20 games, 32 plate appearances, .241 batting average, 1 home run, 7 RBI. Nothing to really write about. I mean, it's a pretty average job by Kittle in 82. Well, 1983 comes along, and it wasn't only Ron Kittle having unexpected success. It's the Chicago White Sox, also known as the Winning Ugly White Sox, found a way to win 99 games that year and clinch the division. Of course, one of the big reasons why was Ron Kittle. 145 games, 570 plate appearances, his batting average .254. He did strike out 150 times, but the reason why we all knew and loved Ron Kittle in 1983, 35 home run, 100 RBI. He was the American League Rookie of the Year. He was an All-Star, which was doubly special because the All-Star game was at Comiskey Park in 1983. And you look at his playoff numbers, he had a pretty decent championship series against the Baltimore Orioles, the team that would eventually go on to win the World Series. As he appeared in three games, had 9 plate appearances, .286 batting average, no home runs, but here was a guy who was able to get on base a few times. He just wasn't able to drive in the runs, which was one of the keys to his success in 83. Now, everybody in 84 is expecting much of the same from not only Kittle, but the White Sox. And that wasn't the case, you know, catching lightning in a bottle like they did in 83 with the win and ugly approach to it. They weren't able to do that again in 84. And much like many other pure power hitters, and I'm not talking about overall great hitters, you know, I'm not talking about the Aaron and the Mays and the Bonds. You know, I'm talking again about the Pete Incaviglia, the Gorman Thomas, the guys that can hit the ball a mile or they strike out. The exact same thing happened to Ron Kittle throughout the next few years. The next year, his batting average plummets to .215. He struck out 137 times. He played 139 games. Still hit 32 home runs. That's what everybody's excited about, right? Well, in 85, you see the numbers scale back a little more. Batting average up to .230, but the home run number's down to .26. In 86, he would actually get traded to the New York Yankees, but his line for the whole season, .218, with how many home runs? 21 home runs. And then later on in his career, you'd see his batting average would come up, but often with hitters, when you work so hard on getting the batting average up, then all of a sudden the home run numbers go down. And this was a guy who never hit more than 20 home runs again in his career. And it was a pretty sordid finish for Ron Kittle. You know, again, this is the guy who had the world in his hand in 1983. Well, at the trade deadline, 1986, traded from the White Sox along with Joel Skinner and Wayne Tolleson to the Yankees. They were making a late pennant run that year, I recall. Ron Hassey, Carlos Martinez, and a player to be named later, who turned out to be Bill Lindsay in the deal. Well, he was released by the Yankees after the 87 season in 1988. He signed as a free agent with the Cleveland Indians, was released after that season, makes a triumphant return to Chicago in 1988, plays there in the 89 season. I should say the 88 offseason is when he returned, but he did play the 89 season, had a .302 batting average, but the home run numbers, again, one of the big reasons why he was so successful. He only had 11 home runs in 1989 with 51 games and 196 plate appearances. So his plate appearances were going down. I believe he was injured that year, but don't quote me on that. In the 1990 season, he starts with Chicago, gets traded to Baltimore for Phil Bradley. after the Orioles can't make it to the top of the AL East. He's granted free agency. He once again goes back to Cleveland in January of 91. They cut him right before the 91 season started. And then in the middle of the 91 season, he comes back to Chicago. He just can't quit Chicago, and the White Sox can't quit him. Well, actually, they did. About 2 months later, he was released by the Sox, playing his last game on August the 13th, 1991. So a guy who in 1983 looked like he was going to be taking over the American League and Major League Baseball by storm. Like, he was joining this wave of youngsters like Gwynn and Boggs and Sandberg, and also, you know, some other young players who had come up over the past few years, Cal Ripken Jr., Ricky Henderson, Kirk Gibson, Paul Molitor, Robin Yount. You think he's going to be joining that echelon of players. Didn't happen. And like I said, I'd love to see a 30 for 30 about Ron Kittle. This is the guy who took the world by storm, looked to be the next big thing in Chicago, in the American League, in Major League Baseball, and a very steady decline, which ended up being a quick decline just 3-4 years later. Now, if you're wondering, Ron Kittle is still alive and well, still doing some work in Chicago with the White Sox, I guess as an alumni PR kind of guy. But also, he has a website, ronkittle.com, and you can buy benches from him. He makes benches out of baseball bats and baseballs, and they look pretty nice. I'm assuming he still makes benches, because based on the news on the front page of the site has not been updated in nearly 3 years to the day. And his memory lives on, his playing memory. Like I said, he's alive. I make it sound like he's dead. His playing memory continues in the baseball cards from that era. And while 83 was a big year for people to go searching for the Ron Kittle rookie cards, throwing away those Sandbergs and Gwynns and Boggs, certainly 84 a good year for the Kittle card as well, because it was able to show what he accomplished in 83 and talked about the promising future for this young man. Now, an interesting thing about the 84 Donruss set and Ron Kittle, this was Kittle's first Donruss card. Donruss actually missed the boat on Ron Kittle in 1983. He had a Topps card and a Fleer card. So this was his first go with Donruss in the 84 set. And like I said earlier, 1984 for me personally was just a great year. I turned 7 years old in 84. I remember a lot of things from my life. That's like the first stretch of my life that I recall pretty much everything. I remember seeing Ghostbusters in the movie theater while we were on a family vacation in North Carolina. I remember actually on that same vacation being introduced to the movies of Mel Brooks, and that was a life-changing positive experience for me. I also remember, you know, it was a great year for music. You had Born in the USA, Bruce Springsteen's album, Purple Rain from Prince. You had Van Halen's 1984. That's another, you know, big media moment for me. So a lot of positive memories from 1984. I remember a lot from there. And if you're a baseball fan, it was a great year, especially if you're a Tigers fan. I know I've got some Padres fans listening. I'm sorry I have to bring up this sore subject. But, you know, the 84 Tigers were just such a dominant team from wire to wire, starting that season 35-5 and just putting a rubber stamp on their championship then and their legacy too. And it still reverberates in Detroit. Last time the Tigers won the World Series, 1984. And if you were a card collector, 84 was a great year as well, not only because you had the second year cards of the players who were starting to establish themselves as stars in Gwynn, Sandberg, and Boggs. Also, all the other players I mentioned earlier, I don't want to go through that laundry list again. But you also saw some pretty good players coming up through the 84 sets. And the 84 Donruss set has some of those players, most notably Don Mattingly, Donnie Baseball. That was the most popular card, without a doubt, from the 84 Donruss set. You can still get it today for a relatively cheap cost. I think maybe $6, $7, $8. Back in the day, it was $30 or $40 to try to track that down. But Don Mattingly, the big rookie from that set, also Daryl Strawberry making his debut in the 84 Donruss set. Joe Carter as well. Carter wearing the Chicago Cubs uni. People forget he was actually brought up through the Cubs organization before he went on to Cleveland and San Diego and Toronto. But those were some of the big cards there from 84. And I absolutely love the 84 design. Let's take a look at the front. First of all, after 3 years of just bumbling through bad photography, Donruss got it right. They got some really good photos, some great action shots, also some really good up-close pose shots, like this shot of Kittle. I mean, this is a studio shot here, and it's very well done. And the way that they designed the front of the card, it really lends itself to the photography. You look at the 81 and 82 and 83 sets, it was more about design. You know, you had big block letters jumping out, or a baseball bat and a ball or a glove, and that big clunky Donruss logo. This time, I'd say probably about 85% of the front of the card devoted to the photograph. And because the photography was so much better and not dark like it had been in previous years, it really stood out. And the 84 Donruss set has some great pictures, including the Ron Kittle one that we have here. Now, really, the only design elements after the photography, the nice white border that kind of sets the photography real well. Down in the lower third, you have this yellow wavy swoosh going from left to right. Not a Nike swoosh, but this kind of a wave that goes from left to right. That's where the team name is included. You do have the legendary clunky Donruss logo, D84 in this case, in the lower right-hand corner. And then at the very bottom, very thin strip, you've got the player's name and position. And it's very simple, very clean, and especially when you compare it to the previous three sets, 84 Donruss is just an absolute winner. They finally got the design right. And I'll talk a little bit about how it became a benchmark in a moment. But first, let's flip the card over. So you see on the back, not too much changing here compared to the 82 and 83 sets. In fact, it's almost a carbon copy of the 83 set. The only difference is the shading on the background. In 83, Donruss going with this dark gold color with the black text on top of it. In 84, they had this kind of a mint jello green color. And I remember that. This is actually a pretty neat color. Or since it was, you know, the summer of Ghostbusters, ectoplasm green, perhaps. We can call it Slimer green. But it looks nice. It really works well. You've got the black text. You've got the green at the top border and then the bottom half where the career highlights are. And Donruss, like they would for a long, long time, sticking with the recent Major League performance stats as opposed to the career stats, something I've never been a fan of. But in the case of a guy like Ron Kittle, who had only been in the big leagues for 2 years prior to the 84 set being released, it looks really good. So the 84 Donruss set, an absolute winner. Great photography, great design. There weren't too many design elements to where they jumped out at you, but that's okay because you had too much clip art design, and you know, it's like Donruss tried too hard in the first few sets. They finally just, you know, it's almost like going into 84, they just said, you know what, we just got to dial it back just a little bit, make it nice and clean and easy to collect. And they certainly did that with the 84 set. Now, if you listen to our podcast on the 83 Fleer set, I mentioned how Fleer really set the bar in 83 with a very classy set and a very business-like set. That's business-like is the term I can think of because it was just so nice and clean and professionally looking. They had that look going for much of the 80s. Well, Donruss would finally set the benchmark here in 84. Was it business-like like Fleer was? No. But some of the elements that you saw in 84, they started using moving forward. And I think you saw, you know, a lot of the clean presentation in the very sharp 85 set, 86 as well, which, you know, I refer to it as the max headroom set because you had that weird, you know, diagonal pattern behind it on the front of the cards, but also some very nice sets, even though they were overproduced, but still very nice sets in the late 80s going into the 90s. So Donruss, it took them 3 years. Fleer took them two, and it took them a dud in 82 to right the ship. Donruss took them 3 years, but the 84 set, they, to use a baseball pun, they hit the ball out of the park here. This is just a great set. A couple other reasons to like this set, too, not just the design elements, not just the star power within it, but also, unlike a lot of the sets from the mid-80s, there actually is a little bit of scarcity to the 84 Donruss set. Reportedly, Donruss dialed back production in 84 just a little bit, probably because, you know, I can't see their accounting books, but I'm sure they were bleeding money for a very long time with some of the sets that they were putting out in the first few years. So they dialed back production just a little bit. So while this is not a very hard set to find or packs or singles to find, you do have to do a little bit of searching for them, but they're still reasonably priced. This isn't like a 74 Tops set. This is something that you can still find, although it still will cost a few dollars if you're looking for packs or complete sets or boxes. Individual cards are still very affordable. Like I said, the Mattingly card, I saw a price like $6 or $7 for. That's the main card in the set there. So still very affordable if you know where to look for it. And of course, that was the opposite of what we saw later on in the decade of the 80s, where there were just cards coming out of every crevice in the planet. The 84 Donruss set is not that case. So there you go. The 84 Donruss set, a winner, just a real gem. Donruss finally getting it right. It's a really nice set. And even the sordid story of Ron Kittle doesn't go by the wayside. Even Ron Kittle and his fall from grace after the 83 season still looks good on an 84 Donruss set. Well, there you go, 84 Donruss, what we've been looking at today. Next time, we're going to take a look at the 84 Fleer set, and that podcast will be coming your way on Friday. In the meantime, follow us on Audio Boom. Send us comments and questions on Twitter at Wax and Gum Stains. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thank you so much for listening to Wax Ecstatic. We'll see you next time.